You are now listening to A Tale from a World Asunder. Welcome back, everyone. My name is Simon, I will be your GM, and I'm joined, as always, by the exceptional Louisa.
Hi there.
And the most excellent Nick.
Hello.
In our last episode, our heroes arrived at the abandoned mine and present shelter for the misbegotten Tres Barrancas, a cleft scar in the face of the earth that houses surprising warmth, if cold comfort given its level of security. Adelaide was reunited with an old friend, Pascal Garas. The gang also met his fiance, the chief of this shelter, Mrs. Otavia, and Mari van der Rohe, a former war mage for the Meridian military, who greatly assisted in both understanding and promising to treat Omar's present condition, with the startling realization that the tattoos on his body were placed there for a combination of transfiguration and magical manipulation. And with that, we actually enter our first period of extended downtime. For those unfamiliar, downtime is any period when nothing specifically is happening, and our characters are free to busy themselves long term in somewhat less tense scenarios than perhaps they would be otherwise.
Adelaide does what he does every time he comes to this port. But before he goes about his routine, he makes three contacts with people within the encampment. The first is with one of the inhabitants he saw yesterday, a certain halfling named Rakim Ferran Oestro. From his ship, Adelaide brings a small box, no bigger than a ring box. Meets Rakim in a meeting location, and after a drink and some pleasantries, Adelaide presents him with the box. Inside, there is a coin that is crafted to be half silver, half gold, with a moon on the silver side and a sun on the golden side. Adelaide has him sign a small receipt for completion of a job well done. He then meets up with another inhabitant that he met the previous day, that he exchanged pleasantries with the previous day, a certain Emer Naithwis, a human with soft, short brown hair and deep spectacles, but one that he is slightly more wary of by reputation. Her, he brings to Freedom's Wings with a small two-man team of strong individuals. He presents her with the painting that she had commissioned many years ago that is finally completed, unwrapping it on the ship so that she can view the work. It is almost Baroque in style and slightly contraband, as it is a depiction of the old world Deva Comet losing its divinity in an act of self-sacrifice to save its lover from a demonic being. Emer also signs the receipt. They take it off the ship safely, and Adelaide goes to find his third appointment. Adelaide will search out one of his very old friends and one of the few people he considers a collaborator in the world. He will look for the shiny black hair and reddened skin of the hobgoblin known as Madwin Fechworu. Does he find them?
Give me an investigation check.
Are these with the new stats, or no?
These are with the new stats. For reference to our audience...
We've leveled up!
Yeah, our players have leveled up.
Let's go! It's a 15. My investigation is still a minus one.
What does Adelaide know Madwin's trade to be, for the most part?
Madwin is essentially a fur trader. Or at least... they're a fur trader in the same way that Adelaide did airship captain.
Which is to say they are successfully?
Which is to say that it is a job that they do, but it is not the thing that they do it for. They do the job so that they have access to other things. And in this particular instance, it is the same thing that they desire access to. It is the reason they are collaborators. Madwin is one of the very few people in Meridia that Adelaide knows has a certain fascination with dragons.
You find your quarry in one of the further in, as in deeper into the mountain, and somewhat seedier halls for entertainment and revelry and companionship. Deep into the ravine, they raise their eyes, which, like many goblinoids, are slightly backlit, a little bit like a cat's, and they light up a little when they see you. Well, ain't you a sight for sore eyes?
Madwin, you mad one. How are ya?
Better having seen you. What can I do you for?
Well, you know, I'm only around for a couple days, probably. I'm not quite sure, actually.
I didn't know we were accepting couriers of your sort.
Well, I wasn't aware of the conditions of the place, and you know how far back Paz and I go.
Right.
So, anyway, I just figured I have some time to kill. Might as well go over our maps, see if we can triangulate anything else.
Right, well, this lockdown's been a ball ache, so I've had nothing better to do.
I can imagine.
It'll be good to feel like we're making progress.
I know.
And they take out a set of charts that you collectively pore over. It's not much by way of news, and it rarely is. Some more reported sightings, a handful more pieces of material evidence found. I mean, tracks in one state, what looks like a leftover nest in another. You and Madwin aren't the only people who share this interest, but for those of you that do, you know that you're starting to chase ghosts. Not all the scars left on this world are as obvious as a ravine cleft into the mountainside. And in fact, many of them leave no trace. As with many an instance of a hyperfixation, this goes well into the evening.
Oh, this goes several days. Every story that they can conjure up, that they've heard in since they've last seen each other, and even some that they've told to each other before, of people talking about a specific place or people talking about draconic lore or anything like that. They just, these stories flow out of them in an almost religious respect. Adelaide pulls out notebooks upon notebooks of stories that he's been told, that he's heard, that he's asked for, that he's traded for. And they do what they can to keep traditions alive.
As one of your sittings is drawing to a close, I think Madwin brings up Well, you see, there's one particularly interesting bit of news. It's not much to go on, but I don't know, it seems worth investigating, if only because of where it's come from. And they point to a spot on the map that's marked with a reported sighting, which is really the most common piece of evidence I think you guys receive. But this does stand out to you because of where it is on the map. This is the first time you've ever seen anything related to dragons come from the capital.
You're fucking with me, right?
I know. I thought it couldn't be... And I mean, some of these stories come from drunk weens or some lout who sees a drake in his sewer pipes and thinks it's a dragon, but I don't know, it's at least a first.
Adelaide leans back, thinking deeply, and goes, it makes a kind of sense when you think about it. I mean, they live off stories, right?
Aye.
How many stories are there about the capital? How many tales do people tell? How many stories of common days do people tell each other each day? You know, a place as densely populated as that.
I know, but interesting enough as it is, and it may be worth looking into more, you know how this works. Best not to get our hopes up.
I know. What's the story? Or who did you hear it from? Or any details?
It was some trader in Ferrumbras, I think. And it was a... as I remember it, it was quite strange. He said he was wandering in a park. And he'd had this feeling like there was some kind of presence watching him, which, to be fair, for city folk isn't a strange in a public park.
Yeah, it's common enough.
But he said he saw this shadow overhead, and it darkened out the moon, and he said was like a bat, only stupid large. And I mean, what else do you read that as?
I mean, I've never known any to be like actual bat shape, but
I mean, if you imagine
the wings alone.
If you imagine it.
No, I'm with you.
Right, it's not much to go on, but
it's more concrete than I've heard before.
And he said this was what really got me. He talked about sulfur, the smell.
Did he mention dragon? Like, did he say the word?
I don't think he had the vocabulary for that, if I'm being honest. He was a fresh off the boat fella.
I mean, because you know as well as I that the more they say the word, the more likely it's not true. It's people, you know, looking for an explanation for like an airship or something. But do you know what park it was? Did he mention it?
They point out on the map of the city which park it was.
Adelaide will spend the next period of time, now that he's met up with and is in contact again with Madwin, he will start doing his usual routine. Which consists of finding a space within one of the market halls, setting up a booth of sorts, even if it's just a table, taking all of the leftover and forgotten remnants of passengers aboard his ship, laying them out on the table and selling them for a small profit. Most of the stuff which he's selling is clothes, trinkets, leftover forks, sometimes a bottle of alcohol. He only sells the unopened ones. And he only keeps for himself what is truly useful. such as his lighter. He's gotten a few nice pens out of it as well. He is less concerned with coin than he is for stories and secrets. Even people who trade with coin, with bullets, with trinkets, a lot of which just goes back on the table. Adelaide asks for a story, even if it's what they did with their day. Sometimes he gets longer, sometimes he gets shorter, but in one of his many notebooks, he writes it down. Every single one. With the stories, what he's trying to do is not only collect stories, especially about Tres Barrancas, but he's also trying to figure out the climate. He's trying to figure out what's going on. He's reading between the lines just to see if there's something that he can do for Paz, for the settlement. He's using it as a weather gauge to a certain extent, of seeing the warning signs before the storm hits.
Give me an insight check.
Oh, very good. And with my new wisdom modifier, very good.
That's a 22.
On that 22, what becomes very clear is the lockdown and the quote-unquote wartime measures have got this place rattled in a major way. You learn that shelves are empty because this place has been raided. Not by people who made it in, as in aggressors, but by people who were inside, got spooked, and took everything they could. There's an overall feeling of betrayal and uncertainty. And I think Adelaide on that 22 recalls how many times he's heard stories like this before, of a settlement that's really just scraping by, and then times get just a little bit tougher and people split. It puts into light the conversation Adelaide had with Paz about putting down roots.
In his head, Adelaide has the thought, if everybody puts down roots, there's nobody to take them out of there when they get scared. And he continues. Barring that, he will take the time to find out a cleric or a healer of some sort to see if he can soothe his injured leg.
I will be making a medicine check for the settlement, as it were. This is not a hospital, but there are people who are capable of healing here. And you might imagine burns are not an uncommon injury.
No.
That's high enough that Adelaide's injury is healed.
Yay.
Meanwhile,
in one of the cavernous, whitewashed rooms, deep, deep into the night, 3-4 a.m., true witching hour, Omar is the only way Mila sees him these days, fast asleep. And she is burning the midnight oil. Mila is going to beg Otavia, a little bit through Paz, for access to whatever arcane textbooks and resources they have, because she needs to study up.
Absolutely. When delving into research, it is incredibly important to set intention. Otherwise, you will just fully get lost in the near infinite sauce that is collective knowledge. What is Mila's intention as she begins delving into the several composite libraries that make up Tres Barrancas book collection.
Mila wants to play to her strengths. She recoils a little bit at the thought, but what she wants to be studying is divination, as always. That's her thing. As well as enchantment. She is very curious about... She knows that Dominate Monster is beyond her reach, and she can't really do much about that, but she would like to be studying these spells that have to do with enchantment and subjugation to get into creature types. What runes bind themselves to which kind of creatures? What glyphs work on what particular people? And how does that work in conjunction with transfiguration, with transmutation? She would like to be studying kind of the overlap on the Venn diagram of enchantment and the part of divination that deals with identification. What can something that is transmutative be identified as? How do the laws of transmutation work when they are subjugated by laws of divination and enchantment?
Give me an arcana check.
Can Pinky help me?
I would say Pinky is helping you in the primary need of every long hour studier, which is he is your caffeine supply.
Amen. A 19 arcana.
This is beyond what Mila got into in school. I mean, it's all based on the same foundations, but I think above all, you get the feeling of getting stuck back into it, of picking up where you left off years ago at this point, a handful of years ago. You're at this point just getting familiar with the territory again.
Okay.
As you do more and more reading on how these kinds of spells work, you gain a more and more morbid sense of appreciation for how powerful a work of magic whatever was put on Omar is. It is absolutely vile. It also takes an incredible amount of skill to do. Because the one thing that magic has great difficulty accomplishing is a lasting, permanent effect on an unwilling participant. That's, on that 19, what all of that amplification magic is there for. And it's also there because another thing wizardly magic has a great deal of trouble with is having a spell effect that co-occurs. Arcane magic, as practiced by wizards, has to be sequential. You have to take multiple rounds to cast multiple spells. You see that the function of a lot of this magic is also effectively what, from a mechanical perspective, we could call metamagic. It is there to quicken the spells such that they happen at the same time as one another. And you see that it's bound up with the transmutation because that's functionally the trigger. Like, the foundation that all of this is built on is the spell that triggers to change shape. Because you also recognize spells like Find Familiar, spells like Dominate Monster, don't work on a target that is Omar, as you know him.
Right.
And I don't know how else Mila would put it in her head than this magic requires a different kind of body to work. And so the foundation of whatever spell this is shaping Omar into that body.
I mean, in the very roundabout way that is so common in academia, this discovery of a trigger, essentially, as part of the spell, does address Mila's original wanderings about creature type that might be subjugated to something or other. And I think it also begins to remind her of what kinds of questions are good to ask when researching. She's getting back into it. She would also, though, share anything she feels is new information with Mari.
Mari has also been researching alongside you for the most part, especially in terms of where you've, I think, more been focusing on what is this spell? What is it about? Like, what is the literal thing that is happening here? Mari's research has basically disregarded that for the equally important question of how can we stop this thing from happening?
Right.
As much as it is possible. What effects can we use to dampen this?
In that case, what she says, what Mila says to Mari, is she focuses on, well, the trigger is the transmutation spell. Nothing can happen. Nothing else can happen without the transmutation.
That's helpful to know. Because of the nature of this magic, it's unclear whether a traditional Wolfsbane would work. You would know that Wolfsbane is the over-the-counter treatment for lycanthropy, insofar as that's a thing we can talk about. It is the long-time healthcare response to what are broadly understood to be transmutative conditions like lycanthropy. Mm. Mari, taking that piece of information, is going to have a leg up on her side of the research. And also, you, as often as possible, you see that you also receive research assistance from Atavia, who is not a magical scholar per se, but is helping much more on the anthropological side.
Mm.
Because a lot of the markings on Omar, they have been described before as ultra textbook, but some of the markings are of non-arcane origin. And Otavia actually chimes in to say that a lot of these markings are Sylvan in origin. So someone has done the work of adding in symbols from a non-standard magic system.
To what effect? To what goal?
Comparing your notes and Mari's with Otavia's, you see that all of the meta magic stuff is Sylvan in origin. All of the stuff about amplifying the spells and having the spells co-occur, all of that magic connecting is Sylvan in origin. As a final note on the sort of collective research that you've done initially, Otavia actually suggests that the next time they visit, you maybe bring in a specialist from the Yanawa, who are the elvish nation who occasionally trade and occasionally raid the area around Tres Barrancas.
Mila nods. She is a little wary of Otavia. I think partly because Adelaide seems to be.
Inherited petty.
But also because the first thing Otavia said to her was, maybe let's not give the girl our rune books straight away. And that never sat right with Mila. So
a reasonable amount of discomfort was never an option.
Absolutely not. So Mila, if she can, while studying with Otavia, would also like to kind of vibe check her, try to see, like,
for sure,
what is this woman's deal? She seems busy, but she's helping me. But, like, she isn't really a mage, but she knows about spells.
Give me an insight check. The most common phrase, I think, on this whole podcast.
That's just a 15.
You understand that this is a person who does genuinely want to help, especially because the people she's helping are very close to someone who's very dear to her. So kind of that sympathetic care is very much a vibe that you pick up from her. But I also think you get the overall energy that this is someone who is busy making sure that things don't fall apart even more than they already have.
Okay.
And I don't know on a 15 if Mila entirely understands why, but there are definitely moments when a boundary is set firmly and further discussion can't really happen past that point. It's not frequent, and it's not in a way that really impedes Mila's research entirely, but especially in regards to combat magic, in regards to resources that seem like they might be necessary to protect this place, it seems like there's kind of a... It's like in a lab, you just can't do something that's a safety concern. That's just impermissible.
Right.
And I think, if I may conjecture, Mila, as a magic student, is not used to being told no.
No, absolutely not. Yeah.
Because that is not the kind of learning environment that the Academy fostered.
Mila gains, I think, a little bit of begrudging respect for Ottavia. Because she's very dope.
She's very dope.
But also...
But she's a hard ass, and that's okay.
I think what that means is Mila probably doesn't have the time and or space to learn a combat spell that she is wanting to pick up, because Ottavia probably doesn't want her to bring a section of their cavernous dwellings down on itself.
Shatter is very much off the table.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, you want to play with C4? No, that will not be happening.
No. Instead, there are a couple of spells that Mila would like to try and learn, though.
Absolutely.
As part of the research, if you would allow it.
Absolutely.
As she goes back into effectively her college notes, Mila finds specifically her dissertation, which is the thing she remembers the best, and was about how divinatory magic is an intrinsically relational magic, how it relies on the relationships between things and on following different parts of the weave that lead from one place to another. It has a little bit of an argument that maybe because divinatory magic is based on holding knowledge and holding identity, that maybe it's a part of every current of magic. That was the controversial point she was trying to make in her associate's degree thesis. Definitely not the time and place for it, but she tried regardless.
Real first semester philosophy student energy off that one.
Yeah. But she goes back into it and she's thinking about creature identification. She's thinking about how to find things out and these kind of like trigger effects on Omar's tattoos. She wants to learn the spell augury.
What object does Mila use to cast augury? Because it does require an object.
This, to Mila, is the part of her study that is to herself. So she isn't doing it in the library. She took a copy of the scroll into the room that she's sharing with Omar. And we come back to this image of her burning the midnight oil. And she gets access to augury, but it's typically cast. And she's heard of it cast more before, back in the old world, where clerics still might cast it. She is looking around for what she might use. She brought a bunch of trinkets. She has crystals in her bag. The thing that she looks to instead is a series of prayer beads Omar has wrapped around the post of their bed. And that's what she's going to take to cast augury with.
As you cast it, you thumb over bead after bead, eyes closed. As Mila learns to cast it, what is the first question that Mila asks?
Augury isn't a spell of questions. It is a spell of omens. She is thinking about Omar, whose breathing seems to have finally regulated into sleep after some good time of pretending instead to be asleep to not bother her. She hasn't talked to him much. She thinks about how they're in a rough patch at the moment and have been since before he left for this deployment, but also strangely a good patch from how they've come together because of it. And in Mila's kind of pragmatic thinking, it should be one or the other. That their relationship can contain both at once, and so much more, makes Mila think she needs nothing short of an omen to help guide her through it.
You thumb over these beads. His beads, technically. You feel that it's right. You feel that whatever you open your eyes to is truth. And as you open your eyes to face it, you lift your left thumb. You see a bead with the mark of blessing upon it. You've received Wheel.
Mila wraps up the scroll she had been copying the spell from and closes her own spell book, leaving the prayer beads on top of it, and kind of sits at the edge of the bed, more or less, and just shakes Omar's shoulder.
Between what Mari is giving him for pain and his overall lack of mobility, he's always somewhere between waking and sleeping. He flutters awake. He looks over and goes, "What time is it?"
It's like 2:30, 3.
I mean, I guess it's something of a luxury to sleep in. As he sort of wakes, wiping the sleep out of his eyes, Omar will push himself up in bed. They don't tell you how much you get taken care of when you're an injured soldier.
I wish I were a little better at it. You know, I gotta keep bringing all these people to dress your wounds, and it's...
Omar gives you a baleful smile. He reaches out a hand and grabs yours.
I know this isn't what you signed up for, but you did come all the way across the country for me. It's okay if you're not the one literally changing my bandages.
Don't let it get to your head.
He, for the first time in a long time, actually laughs.
Mila laughs with him. It's a frown along with a smile, and a knot in her chest along with its untangling. She says, I would do it again and again and again. I might not be much of a nurse, but I mean, I spent all of these years learning and perfecting magic, and I'll be damned if I can't use it to save you.
So then, if you've perfected the magic, what's the prognosis? Do I have a couple years at least? A couple weeks?
She hits him playfully in the chest and says, "You're not going anywhere. I mean, you're not going anywhere if it's on me. But I don't know, Omar. I can't imagine what's happening to you. I mean, literally the magic of it, but also I can't imagine what it feels to be right now, but still it's we're doing so much, and I will do more. I'll do what it takes. I know I haven't always said that, but I will. But I've noticed you're a little...
He raises his hand from yours towards your face.
I'm worried about you.
Listen, I have every intention of surviving until my mother kills her firstborn for getting tattoos. His face darkens, and he says, "Whatever you may have overheard, I cannot, and I will not compromise your safety." End of story.
Mila hangs on to his hand. Omar, you wouldn't. You don't have to worry about that. You wouldn't. In the forest, when you were different, it didn't matter. It's still you.
I can't remember anything I did in those woods. That I didn't kill you, I consider a miracle.
Miracle is not a word in which Mila believes. She looks at him and she knows that even if things had been different, she, not through faith but through science, has the ability to change them.
Louisa, roll me a persuasion check.
Natural one.
Omar doesn't say anything else in this moment. His body grows limp, and he falls back onto the wall of pillows behind him. And you know that you have a couple seconds of consciousness left.
Mila is still sitting on the bed, but gets closer to him, is holding his face to look at hers, and she says,
"I know I've just earned it, but you've got to trust me. I know you can't remember it, but I can. I'll be your keeper."
Of course. Of course I trust you. And he falls into a drugged slumber.
There is also something else that Mila, before kind of dealing with the matters at hand, would like to do in this time of rest.
Absolutely.
She goes up to Mari and says, "Do you have a scroll of sending I could use? I really need to get in touch with things I left in the city."
Mari, I think, redirects you to Otavia, who is sort of in charge of the settlement's relatively limited supply of sending to the outside.
She says, "I'm willing to pay handsomely."
I think Otavia will let you use one in this particular instance without payment, with the understanding that you do not, in the sending, explain where you are in any substantive way.
Mila compromises to that very easily. She didn't mean to. Mila sends a sending out to her younger brother, Antonino Bentezza. Nino found Omar, safe but in hiding. Tell boss only I've happened upon suspect military activity. Would like to be kept on to investigate, Mila.
It takes a second as the spell goes out, but after a little while, you receive a response. Holy shit. Okay. We'll tell boss, are you a spy now? Family is okay. Glad Omar isn't dead. Hoping you get home safe. Love you, Nino.
I love him so much. I wish I had. Mila wishes so badly she had like 49 other sending spells because she just wants to text her little brother. But
Mila lets Adelaide know that she's been able to get in touch with her family back in the city and hopes to hear about possibly still having a job soon. As Mila talks to Adelaide, I think as the days go by, it's not hard to pick up on the fact that she is not letting up. She is gearing up for a hunt. She has no idea what it'll take. She's still doing it.
Can I ask Mila to roll an insight check on Adelaide?
I don't know. Can you? That's a 5 total. Blinded by rage.
Okay. Adelaide seems interested in what you're saying. He receives the information and doesn't necessarily offer his aid explicitly, but he doesn't say anything that would make Mila think he's not interested in joining her in this crusade.
She does go ahead and say also, I mean, in the meantime, if you've got any jobs, also, as long as you're on, we're paying. Omar's family has some pretty substantial coffers and better into your pockets than city slickers.
I'm not looking to extort you folks. While we're in dock, I'm here for transport. And, you know, I'm trying to lead you somewhere, that's a different story. But at the moment, I am, for all intents and purposes, off of your clock. Now, if you want to pay me extra, I'm not going to complain. But it will be a bonus and not, I'm not going to charge you for this time.
I'll pay for your beer. How about that?
Sounds fun.
I'll say the time, and at this point we're talking about a week bleeding into 2 goes by. Just enough that you kind of settle into something approaching rhythm. And things are tense. I mean, the whole place is tense. But in that tension, in that uncertainty, everyone is just that little bit more giving to one another, and the party enjoys for the first time in a little bit, like, truly full bellies and truly full night sleeps, a true long rest. Omar starts walking. He looks quite out of place, clothed in essentially Paz's hand-me-downs, but charisma check. He's really pulling it off, honestly.
Mila's like, should Omar be a cowboy?
He's now sporting an eye patch. Most of his bandages are gone. Like, the wounds have closed up, and the ones that haven't are not in places visible. He's grown out the stubble a little bit, to the point where he looks way more rugged, I think, than Mila has ever seen him.
Yeah.
And as soon as he starts walking, he arranges with Paz to start training again. Full-on fencing practice happening in the settlement, just to be physical again, and just to feel like he's arming himself.
Adelaide will join him. Not always, but armed with a large dagger in one hand and a hand axe in the other, his Bowie knife and tomahawk, he will absolutely join in and join the melee. I think Adelaide starts to stick to a schedule. He works out, he trains, he does his selling, he does his coordination with Madwin, and he checks in on his ship and his crew daily. He will just start taking care of the ship, fixing anything that he has supplies for that's broken, spending some time with each of them, working through more difficult fixes that need four hands, basically, and just start getting it in really solid condition. He will also make sure that the kobolds are using this opportunity with the resources that are at hand to learn and to do more. He does lessons with them, continuing their progression into learning Medidas, and makes sure that they have access to whatever resources they need to further their own little studies.
All of Tres Barrancas also kind of operates on a policy of who doesn't work doesn't eat. And so I think that the kobolds are very much put to use in the places where they've landed. Although it's of course understood that they're your crew, but they're sort of apprenticed in all of these various places.
They are still their own people.
Yeah. I think similarly, at some point, Mila, Mari is going to propose a little bit of like a combat magic crash course.
All Let's right. go. Mila's so scared.
I think she says to you, like, listen, if there's one thing I've learned from military experience, it's stay ready so you don't have to get ready.
All right.
And I think she walks you through, this is how to recognize somatic components for powerful combat magic. This is how, even if you can't cast it, these are the basics of it, just to get you thinking in those terms.
Could she maybe teach Mila a single first level damage dealing spell?
I think Mari says, in terms of combat magic, there's a real basic spell that's going to be useful in a lot of different situations. And that's really, at the basics, what's going to be important. And I think Mari walks you through the components for casting Chromatic Orb.
Mila feels very powerful with crackling energy in her hands.
At a certain juncture, the settlement is visited by a band of Yanawa. The Yanawa are a group that actually I think Adelaide has maybe had some dealings with, because they are airborne. Like many of the peoples that have traditionally populated this part of what is now the state of Arcadia, they raise griffins.
Very cool.
Sick as hell.
They are airborne shepherds and merchants and raiders. You see, as they arrive in the settlement, a contingent of them, maybe 15, 16 people strong, dressed in a mix of Meridian garb and feathered and leather implements. Benefit of a griffin is you can get both.
Mila, as they come in, will be kind of like looking on to their interactions with Otavia, because it isn't exactly clear to her whether these are friends or foes. She understood them being mentioned in the wartime measures situation.
I also think, Mila, you would know the Yanawa chiefly from news stories about them.
Okay.
You can imagine a group of semi-nomadic airborne warriors have had a tendency over the past several years to get into fights.
Yeah.
With people that I think the Tribune would have simply described as Meridians, leaving out the perhaps more important part of their description as settlers. And you see they've brought various things to trade and sell in exchange for things that they don't have access to from elsewhere, things that this settlement can provide.
All right.
As the settlement sort of comes to greet them, Otavia meets up with one of them. And I would like either of you... Actually, what is your passive perception, Adelaide?
22.
How?
Observant.
Oh my god.
And Mila, what is your passive perception?
Worse. Bad, even. 10.
Adelaide, you overhear an exchange in Elvish, which thankfully you do speak. The figure talking to Otavia, who's a, I want to say like 5'8", 5'9", younger elf, says, "More movement further south. Another company, we think. We were spotted. Keep a lookout." And then he rejoins his party.
Uh-huh.
I think there is a little bit of information exchanged between one of the maybe elder members of the band that have arrived here and Mari regarding some of the symbols. While Omar is hidden from view, and the symbols are sort of viewed in abstract through Mari's notes.
Mila and Mari have probably a pretty detailed copy of what the design looks like. And Mila, knowing that there's tension between these people and the troop movements, does give up that they think it's some experiment by the Meridian Army that they are very much looking to put a stop or an end to.
Yeah, give me a persuasion check. Mari will give you the help action.
19 total.
The elder with whom you are interacting, who introduced himself as Jacinto, takes a pause. Very old, lined face that kind of doubles over in a mixture of concern and undeniable rage. Mila is not an Elvish speaker, correct?
No, but if she has gotten the impression that they would like to communicate in Elvish, she'll have cast Comprehend Languages, but she can't speak Elvish.
Yes.
But she will be understanding it.
He doesn't say much, but just...
"Then let the enemy of our enemy be our friend. We'll keep an eye out. You might want to take a look at some of the things we've brought." And he gestures. So one of the goods that the Yanawa here sell is paper.
Okay.
And their source of paper is when they raid military encampments, they steal the ledgers.
Hell yes.
And you you remember the artist in the entertainment hall who was sketching on a ledger. And you realize this might be an opportunity to maybe scratch at something like intel.
Yes, Mila's eyes shine.
What does Mila have to trade?
Mila takes out the last of her star blossom essence, the capital cultivated flower, which serves as a little bit of a magical repository, and she's sure people will have more uses for. She gets someone to communicate that she'd be glad to supplement it with Senya, but that this is what she can think of most value to exchange.
I'll say you ride that 19 persuasion check. You've made a decent impression. You're able to get a handful, like three or four ledgers in exchange for basically some material spell components and a handful of Senya that they will use somewhere or other.
Yummy!
I will say, Jacinto's band of Yanawa take their leave, and you learn from Otavia that they come sort of cyclically, partly because they need a place where they can sell things non-legally. And also because I think as you have that conversation with an elder here, there is a shared sense of being threatened for very different reasons. But both are threatened by the increased presence of the military. And again, it's that feeling of sometimes when things get desperate, people are a little more willing to share. It becomes clear that these kinds of market visits are what is sustaining the settlement here. These brief instances where outsiders come and exchange. And I think you notice, because of how necessary they are, everyone's guard slips a little when they happen. Because the flood of new stuff is a little too hard to resist.
Adelaide, during these visits from outsiders, will join whatever watch force there is, offering his services as a bit of muscle. He will patrol very, very visibly with a Razi that has grown over the past few weeks and is now just a little too big to sit comfortably on his shoulders. So walks now at slightly above ankle height at about mid-calf, and with his shotgun weapons by his side, now clean poncho, thoroughly cleaned poncho on, bright and unmistakable as someone not to trifle with, and he is keeping a very close eye on everybody and is making it very clear that he's doing so.
A rugged looking party of people who are unfamiliar to the settlement come through loaded with supplies. Adelaide has been swept up in this kind of culture of vigilance around Tres Barrancas that has arisen out of necessity, but even he can't deny that this would be a tremendous opportunity. And so as this group is let in and people come out to trade,
Adelaide would like to look specifically for any hidden sign that this might be military. It feels a little too convenient.
Give me an investigation check.
Audience, you can't see this, but Simon just grinned.
Do I have advantage from Razi?
Yes.
You're so nice to me. That is a natural 20.
Razi!
It was a 9 and a natural 20.
I think the function of that advantage is that Razi notices something before you do and kind of creeps into this group of men with their supplies, with the implication being that you should follow. You see that people have already started coming into the antechamber to commence exchange with these people.
Adelaide, before he steps into this group, will make eye contact with Paz.
You lock eyes with Paz, who is sort of supervising. You sidle up to one of the strangers, a human, only a couple inches shorter than you, so it's quite large, who is accompanied by another man, much shorter, kind of wiry. And they've both placed their weapons on the counter, but have not taken hands off them. You see that Razzie, uncharacteristically, leaps up onto the big guy and pulls down a shirt just enough to see red, ashen scars tattooed into the upper chest. In this exact moment, Mila, he's been walking around and he's curious as hell. Omar enters the antechamber. The wiry man turns to you, Adelaide, turns to Omar, turns back to you. Looks like you've got some that belongs to us, partner.
Tales from World Asunder is Luisa Zanardi as Mila, Nick Sturman as Adelaide, and Simon Ivchevich as the world falling apart around them.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening.
Her Imperial Excellency is looking for adventurers to expand the known world, regardless of creed or circumstance. Are you brave enough to answer the call? Join the Survey Corps today. Push the boundaries of civilization and help tame the wild beyond our borders. Sign up today at the nearest military recruitment center, the INR Survey Corps. Beyond borders, beyond bravery.